January 18, 2017. I'm Rico Bishop, and I am pleased to be joined today by retired Supreme Court Justice Mike McCormick and Judge Francie Reedman. We are being live streamed on NETV, so we would remind you to be cautious of any sensitive material, since the materials will be available to the public. When I call your case, please approach, and then as the appellant's attorney approaches the podium, I'll repeat the name. If you could wait for me to do that for live streaming purposes, we'd appreciate it. All right. So the first case of the day is In Re Estate of Ackerman. Again, the first case is In Re Estate of Ackerman. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, esteemed judges of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. My name is Wayne Jansen. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Sandra Underwood. The opinion of the county court in this matter is clearly erroneous. The county court admits that appellee had no right as an agent. She was only a POD beneficiary. Then the court states that Exhibit 47 was to take away the right of the appellee as agent. She was never an agent. It's a legal nullity if that's all that Exhibit 47 was good for. Elsie must have had a reason to execute Exhibit 47. Then the court states that Exhibit 48 was only to give Ernie rights as an agent. She cites to evidence that Ernie did not ever want the money. And this is where it gets interesting. The court makes the finding that access had to mean the same in both documents, Exhibit 47 and Exhibit 48, because they were executed on the same day. There's no requirement that access means the same thing in both exhibits. The fact that it was done on the same day is irrelevant. The same form could be used for different purposes. The form was not in compliance with Nebraska Revised Statute Section 30-2917A. The court must look to the intent of Elsie. The court says there was no effort to make a change to the account type, the POD account type. The removal of a POD beneficiary causes a survivorship to fail. Nebraska Revised Statute Section 30-2723B2 states that if we don't have a POD beneficiary, the POD part of the account fails. The custodian...
Counsel, do you agree at one point this was a POD account?
Oh, yes. At one point it was. It was. But the POD beneficiary was removed. Access was removed, and that's the only access that the POD beneficiary had. That's what Exhibit 47
was. Was removed by a document that was signed by Elsie?
Yes, Exhibit 47 was signed by Elsie. And Exhibit 48 was also signed by Elsie. These are the last two documents that are signed by Elsie. The custodian of the records, Ms. Calkins, said that Exhibits 47 and 48 were used to change access. He also said that there were no other documents used by the bank for this purpose, and that's at page 274, line 22.
Well, did these documents that you say removed them say, does it say in there, I'm removing you as POD?
It says,
or is it only talking about access, which is a different subject entirely?
Well, not necessarily, because the only access she had was to receive funds upon death. That's the only access she had, and that's the access that was removed. The custodian of the records also said that these forms were used to take persons off an account. That's found at page 293, line 18. The execution of Exhibit 47 did change the account. Now, the appellee will make the argument that there's never been a change, but in fact, there has. Otherwise, Exhibit 47 is nothing, and it seems illogical to assume that she would go in and the bank officer would give her forms to sign, and that she would sign them for absolutely no purpose, since there was no access other than as a payable on death beneficiary.
Neither Exhibit 47 nor 48 comply with the provisions of the statute. Though,
right. That's why we have to look at intent. We can look at what the banks use them for, and then we have to look for the intent. The court says that looking at the totality of the evidence shows that there was an intent to make a gift. Well, if we look at the totality of the evidence, we see Exhibit 45 granting the POD on this account was made during the divorce proceedings of Elsie in 1977. It'd be anybody's guess for sure what the purpose was, but it was probably to keep the husband before the divorce was final. The divorce became final in 78. from getting this money if she were to pass away. This Ernie moved in 1978, and Exhibit 47 and 48 were both issued on the same date, April 3rd, 1986. They were both signed by Elsie. And the one, 47, took Judith off, and 48 put Ernie on. And the thing is, other than the presumption of the court that they had to mean the same thing, there is nothing in the evidence that says they meant the same thing. There is evidence that shows that Ernie never wanted to have any of the money. She didn't want him to have any of the money. So we can say that Exhibit 48 was for the purpose of designating an agent. But the word access has a myriad of meanings. It's not limited on a particular day to a particular type of document that doesn't comport with the statute. Exhibit 39 was executed in May of 1987, and it's a deed that gives the remainder of all the real estate to the children equally. And this shows the intent of Elsie to give her property equally to her children. Now, Exhibit 5 is Elsie's will. That was made on 11/1/94. That leaves all the personal property to the children equally. The real property had already been divided. And it also shows her intent to give her property equally to her children. Now, there's Exhibit 49 and 50. These were not signed by Elsie. And the court made mention that these were filed at Elsie's request. Well, I don't think the evidence is totally clear on that. But they are without signature. The one, Exhibit 50, which supposedly puts Judith back on, does not meet the requirements of the statute because it's not signed. It may have been delivered to the court, but it was never signed by Elsie. And Exhibit 49 was only signed by Ernie, but he was just taking himself off. Said, I don't want it. He was renouncing whatever interest he had in the account. Now, Elsie also purchased bonds with each of the children being listed, and there's five of them, with each of the children being listed as beneficiaries. And that also included Judith. She made some bonds for Judith, too. This also shows the intent that she had to divide her assets equally amongst her children. Now, the court seems to put emphasis on the fact, or what she claims to be the fact, that Judith visited several times and Sandra few times. Well, the thing we need to understand here is that this is not an action between Judith and Sandra. This is an action to bring these assets back into the estate so they can be divided pursuant to the will in the estate proceedings to the five children. So whether there's a difference in the number of visits between these two parties, that's irrelevant. In any event, it doesn't justify a $200,000 gift in light of all of the evidence. All the evidence leads to Elsie's intent to treat all the children the same. Now, even Judith did not think she had a survivor interest initially. She reimbursed the account for money she'd spent on a sink after death. In her petition, she claims she's not a creditor, but by that time she'd already spent money out of that account. It's several thousand dollars. And she then filed a claim, then she released the claim. And then, during the evidence, she made repeated statements that she was claiming only because of the position of the bank. The bank had told her that she was the owner. And surely the bank doesn't determine these issues of law and fact. Now, Exhibit 25, the POA for Judith, it does have some significance in this matter. It shows that Elsie was trying to prepare for her upcoming old age. I mean, that's part of what she was doing. It was given to the bank. It was possible justification for the bank to even take Exhibit 50. Exhibit 25 is relevant for the violation of the duty as a fiduciary. It's a possible foundation for the constructive trust. And after Exhibit 25 and 50, there were no nursing home expenses because Judith kept claiming that there was no money. So there is an indication there could have been a self-interest. It's not reasonable to ignore all this evidence and decide the case on pure speculation, not supported by any real evidence or the law. The decision of the county court is clearly erroneous. Thank you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Joel Bacon. I represent the appellee, Judith Boljak. Just to kind of clarify what the actual issue is in this case, the county court was asked to decide a factual question. What did Elsie Ackerman intend to do when she executed the removal of access document in 1986? Was it her intent to remove my client and death beneficiary? That's a factual question for the county court to determine, and of course the standard of review is clear error, which is an exceedingly high standard given what the factual nature of the question that we're looking at. It was a deceased woman intending to do. There are several factors that support the county court's decision. The first is the removal of access document itself. As Judge McCormick pointed out, it does not mention at all the term payable on death. It does not mention the term POD beneficiary. The only term it uses is access. A pay on death beneficiary does not have any access to an account. The only person that has access to the account is the account owner. So it makes no sense that this document would have been used to remove a pay-on-death beneficiary.
What explanation is there for the document?
I think there's a couple of possible explanations. One is if you go back and look at the initial document that opened up the account, Judith Buljak is actually named as a signatory on it. That's crossed out. We don't know when it was crossed out. No one could testify to that. But you could easily envision a bank employee when she comes in 1986 and says, I want to add my boyfriend as somebody who's going to be able to sign on this, and they look back at this and say, hey, there's this goofiness in the original document that was open. Let's just clarify that you don't want Judith Buljak to have any access, any ability to sign off on checks. Right now, beyond that, if we look at what happened contemporaneously when the document was signed by Mr. Symes to make him, or by Elsie Ackerman to make Mr. Symes give him access to that account, what the county court did is said, I'm going to construe two terms consistently. Access appears in both of these documents. And what we know is that there was no intent to name him as the pay-on-death beneficiary when she granted access in 1986. And so what Judge Parsley did is said, I'm going to construe that consistently, those two terms consistently, in these two documents which were signed contemporaneously. That's not clear error for the judge to say, I'm going to give a term that's used in documents on the same day, at the same time, the same meaning. They might not like that that's a reasonable conclusion to make, but it is a reasonable conclusion. Beyond that, there's evidence that this is, in fact, what she would have intended. Judith Buljak testified that her mom always told her that she wanted her to have this account. And there was evidence, as Judge Parsley pointed out, that they had a closer relationship than she had with her other children. My client took care of her. My client visited her more often. And it follows from that. That supports the conclusion that she wanted one made. She would have wanted to make an extra gift to my client that she wasn't going to leave each of the other children. And that's common in estate planning. We see that all the time where a parent says, look, I have four children. I love them all, but one of them has done more for me. I have a closer relationship with them, and I want to make special arrangements for them. And one way to do that is through a pay-on-death account. So that's not uncommon at all. The reliance upon the remainder of the estate plan is nothing more than speculation. The fact that she would have wanted to leave other components of her estate equally amongst her other children does not mean that she wanted to leave this account to her children in equal shares, too. That's an inference they're attempting to draw. And of course, on a clear error basis, we get the benefit of reasonable inferences, not them. So that's an inappropriate inference that they're attempting to draw. I also think it's worth noting the type of evidence that they could have brought forth that they did not bring forth. They could have brought forward someone who was there, tried to find someone who was there when this document was signed. They could have found someone who was around Elsie Ackerman contemporaneously when this was being signed to get some sense of what she was doing. They didn't present any of that evidence. The closest we get is my client's testimony that mom told me I would always have this account.
And her boyfriend, actually. Doesn't his also support your client's position?
Yes, that they had a close relationship, that my client's the one who was over there taking care of mom and being with mom. And also, of course, that's consistent with his testimony that this isn't, I'm not a pay-on-death beneficiary.
If we construe it as the county court did, Exhibit 47 is really a nullity, isn't it? Because Judith didn't have any access to the account.
Yeah, that's... But that,
is that a problem?
No, I don't think that's... First of all, kind of to go back to the point that there is this other document where you could see, hey, this is a little goofy in this record. Let's clarify this. That could have happened. Beyond that, you know, another component of this is I don't think we have to give meaning to every single form that's ever been executed at a bank. I don't think that's a requirement in something like this, where we're trying to figure out what somebody's intent was with respect to filling out this document. Maybe the clerk just gave her this form and said, since you're adding Ernie for him to make checks, let's make sure that we're going to make it clear that Judith can't write checks. That's possible. That could have happened. And on a clear air standard of review, given the other circumstances, given the other evidence that support our position, that's perfectly reasonable. So but I know I said,
did the status of the, was the status of the account always as a single party?
Yes.
Account?
Yeah, there's this whole discussion in the brief about whether or not my client attempted to add herself as a joint owner, and that's all irrelevant. What comes down to it is the 86 document. We're not making any contentions that she was ever added in the 90s.
Would that be problematic for you?
Yeah, I think that it was open as a single account. In 1977, she added my client as a pay on death beneficiary. The issue is, was she ever rated as a pay on death beneficiary? And there is. The question is whether or not that 1986 document did it. In concluding it didn't, the court didn't commit clear error. I know I said clear error about 40 times, but that is what this case turns on.
Our standard review.
So thank you, Your Honors. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Is there any rebuttal time?
Thank you.
Mr. Jansen, is it a factual question?
I think it's actually a legal question. There's facts involved, but I think it's a legal question as to what the essence of those documents were. If you listen to his argument, it could have been. It's reasonable to presume. We could kind of suggest, we're talking 30 years ago. We're supposedly deficient because we can't find a clerk that was in a bank 30 years ago. I mean, that's not really realistic. When you look at the hard factual evidence, I think we meet whatever standards are necessary here, because when you look at the actual factual evidence, not suppositions, the fact of the matter is the only reason she was put on there was because her mother was engaged in a divorce. He says, well, Mom told her. There's no time reference in the record as to when Mom told her. Certainly, when she was put on as a POD beneficiary, she would have been told, you're going to get this money when I die. But that changed with Exhibit 47.
Well, is there any other evidence in the record regarding the bank's documents for removing a POD that would have been different than Exhibit 47?
If you look at Ms. Calkins' testimony, you'll see that there really wasn't any other document to do that. These were the documents that were used to take people off of accounts, put people on, grant them access, remove their access. This is what they used, and they used it for a myriad of purposes. It's illogical to say, well, in this case, just because the person's sitting down and I want to do this type of a transaction here and this type over here, that those two have to melt together and be the same.
Okay.
Are we good?
Anything else? Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Jansen. The matter is submitted. Thank you both very much. Next case is Perea versus Gomez.